The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from oprahmag.com. All right, this first article is called Gail King Opens Up About Daughter Kirby Bumpus' Wedding. I'm over the moon. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, our editor-at-large, Gail King, was busy dreaming up plans for her daughter Kirby Bumpus's wedding to then-fiancé Virgil Miller. But with suddenly having social distancing and travel and quarantine protocol to consider, Kirby and Virgil live on the West Coast while Gail is on the East Coast. The family quickly realized it was time for a plan B. So, in December, just before 2020 came to an end, Kirby and Virgil said I do at Kirby's godmother Oprah's Santa Barbara home with a very small guest list. Oprah, Stedman, and of course, the mother of the bride, and Kirby's brother and Gail's son Will officiated. It wasn't the wedding we planned, but it was absolutely perfect, Gail says, sharing an exclusive photo of the happy couple with OprahMag.com. And the photo shows Kirby smiling and gazing into her new husband's eyes. They're standing on a balcony, and she's wearing a wedding dress. Gail first announced the nuptials on February 1st on CBS This Morning and admits she's been bursting since December to share. But she respected Kirby's wishes to keep the news to close family and friends first. But now Gail says she's glowing and over the moon, and Kirby clearly is too, especially in the photos captured by their photographer, Joe. Joe doesn't normally do weddings, but Oprah just so happened to be shooting something on her property that got canceled at the... Okay, this next article is called, After Learning He Was Adopted, This Man Chose to Reconnect with the Family That Gave Him Up. Matthew Gomes' decision to track down his family gave him answers and a lesson about true love. However, Kirby and Virgil had to adapt in many ways in order to ensure everyone stayed safe and healthy. Kirby held her dress fittings via Zoom, with Oprah, Gail, and her best friend offering feedback virtually. And on the day of the wedding, Gail wasn't able to go into the house to help Kirby get ready, which she admits was really tough. And the plan had not originally been for her brother Will to officiate, but given that he already had a license after presiding over a friend's wedding, it felt like the right decision. Nobody knows Kirby the way her brother does, so for him to do the ceremony felt meant to be, Gail says. She adds that after exchanging vows, the family did socially distant hors d'oeuvres and cake and socially distant dancing. In the end, what was most important was celebrating Kirby and Virgil's love. And the couple had a beautiful day they will always remember. My son Will says, we call ourselves a tripod, and that day with Virgil, we became a perfect square. Gail says, Kirby really is so happy, and nothing beats when your children are happy. Congratulations to the happy couple, Kirby and Virgil. OprahMag.com team wishes you a lifetime of happiness. This next article is called, After Learning He Was Adopted, This Man Chose to Reconnect with the Family That Gave Him Up. Until he reached elementary school, Matthew Gomes did not know he was adopted. I grew up in a little suburban town in California, Matthew, who was born Frederick Allen, tells OprahMag.com, adding, childhood was great. Still, Matthew couldn't escape the feeling that he was somehow different than the other members of his family. As a kid, I felt like Casper the Friendly Ghost, remembers Matthew. When he was a young boy, Matthew's parents sat him down and explained that he was adopted. He was shocked. It left an odd emptiness in my spirit as a kid, not knowing who this mysterious woman was that gave me up for adoption, says Matthew. His adoptive parents told him what little they knew about his birth family, that they had gone through hardships in the past, which had led to the decision to give Matthew up for adoption. As painful as it was to learn that he was adopted, Matthew's adopted mother supported him completely. I had the love, patience, and faith of my adoptive mother to help me get through the hard times, he says. I decided to take the leap of faith. I just wanted to finally meet my birth family. Matthew was 25 years old when he began looking into DNA testing, but it was nearly a decade later when he decided to delve deeper into his history. The first DNA test gave him names of family members, and a second helped him better understand his ethnic background. Matthew learned that he was Portuguese, Italian, and Greek, and that he shared DNA with members of the House of Grimaldi. "It answered a lot of health questions for me," says Matthew, but he debated reaching out to his birth family. Did he really want to see them? Would they actually want to meet him? After enduring a particularly difficult time in his life, Matthew decided it was time to make contact with his birth mother. With the help of a close friend, Matthew pulled her address from census records and discovered that she lived near him in Sacramento. His friend drove him to her house, knocked on the door, and asked the woman if she'd given a baby up for adoption in 1986. She said yes, and with tears, they fell into one another's arms. "My birth mother was hugging me and kissing me and saying that she always remembered me because she named me after her father and brother, Frederick," remembers Matthew. His birth mother, Renee, called his two brothers and they drove over immediately. "It was like a movie scene," says Matthew, of the reunion. Renee told Matthew that when one of his brothers was little, he used to go around the house crying, asking where was Freddie. Matthew stayed the entire day with his birth family. By the time he got home that night, he finally felt at peace. Since that day, he's reconnected with his extended biological family, including his uncle and aunt, who also live in Sacramento. He now sees them all regularly and recently attended his birth mother's 63rd birthday party. "It's been an interesting adventure with my birth mom and her family," says Matthew, who adds that while it hasn't always been easy moving on from the past, he's grateful to have had this opportunity to reconnect. 2 years after meeting him, Matthew's birth father passed away. "I remember holding his hand and him crying. He couldn't speak but whispered, 'I love you,'" remembers Matthew. The person Matthew relates to the most is his biological grandfather, a dancer and musician who Matthew had never had the chance to meet. Matthew, who took up belly dancing and fire dancing when he was a teenager, believes he inherited his love of dancing from his grandfather. "I share the artistic and spiritual qualities that he had. One of his quotes was, 'No matter how bad things go in life, all you can do is love your children,'" says Matthew, adding that even through life's darkest lessons, he believes love can conquer all. Okay, this next article is called "Yes, You Can Set Boundaries with Basically Everyone. Here's How." Parents, in-laws, spouses, bosses, kids, exes. We have a million people to please on a daily basis, and it's no simple task to manage the demands and take care of our own needs at the same time. But believe it or not, we can do something about it. It is called setting boundaries. "Boundaries are essential in every relationship," says Dr. Aziz Ghazapura, clinical psychologist and author of Not Nice. "Without boundaries, you may end up feeling burnt out and resentful," he says. "Of course, it can feel super uncomfortable to tell the people you care about to back off. So we have enlisted the experts to tell us how to tactfully set healthy boundaries without setting any fires. First of all, most nice people are afraid of upsetting others and being perceived as rude, mean, or selfish," says Ghazapura, who points out that our fear of disapproval is the core reason many of us have difficulty setting boundaries. Nancy Levine, life coach and author of the upcoming book, Setting Boundaries Will Set You Free, agrees. "We often say yes when we should be saying no because we are concerned that we will hurt someone's feelings. It's our fear that keeps us in this people-pleasing, over-giving mode," she says. "But the best way out of fear is through it," according to Ghazapura, who notes that once we take the risk of setting a boundary, we will find that people won't react in anger. "Most people actually care about what you want," he says. Levin says setting a boundary consists of two clear parts. The first is a request, and if necessary, a declaration of intention. start by stating clearly what is acceptable and what is unacceptable to you. This is the request. For example, you could say to your partner, "When your brother makes inappropriate comments, I feel angry and uncomfortable. I don't want to see him socially except at family gatherings. Does this work for you?" Then state the consequence. If the other party is unable to meet your request, the next step is to take care of yourself, says Levine. This is when you let the person know how you're going to handle the situation, she says, stressing that it's important to have a backup plan in place before you make the boundary request. So, in keeping with the example above, if your spouse will not meet your needs, despite your concerns, you may respond, "Since you still want to see your brother socially, I will simply make other plans when you two go out." Now be prepared to follow through. Do not set boundaries you aren't willing to enforce, says Sunny Joy McMillan, certified life coach and author. If there is no accountability, then the boundary is basically non-existent. Keep in mind, this is not your way of controlling other people. Instead, she says, it's a way to honor and protect your own physical, emotional, and energetic space. When setting a boundary, be confident. Often we feel like we need to provide an excuse or an explanation when we feel insecure about a choice, says McMillan. And Levine agrees. We apologize because we're uncomfortable. She says if you have the tendency to say, "I'm sorry," every time you say no to something, it sends a mixed message that weakens and dilutes your position. Instead, she says, remember, you're not doing harm in refusing to attend to another's demands. Also, use I statements. While you may need to mention the other person's behavior, bring it back to yourself. This keeps the focus on your feelings. For example, if your in-laws are consistently criticizing your food choices for your children, you can say, "Please don't comment on what or how much my children eat. I will be in charge of that." When we're clear about how people can treat us, it makes our interactions much easier. But be careful not to place blame. If you're upset, it may be hard to keep your anger in check. So if you say something accusatory, you open the door for an argument that may do more harm than good. McMillan suggests taking timing into account when you set your boundaries to avoid a screaming match. Don't set them when you're feeling frustrated, resentful, and angry. Instead, she says, wait until you've had time for some reflection and you're feeling composed. And remember, don't freak out if there's pushback. New boundaries do have the potential to change a family or workplace system, says McMillan. You're likely to ruffle some feathers, but don't let that stop you. Instead, choose to see the pushback as an indication that you really are making healthy changes. Realize it may take time for everyone to get on board. Don't try once and then give up if it doesn't go the way you want. The more you practice, the better your results will be. Okay, and our next article is about the new Sex and the City revival. The Sex and the City revival will incorporate the COVID-19 pandemic. Though we don't have a release date yet, Sex and the City is officially returning to TV. The series will reunite Sarah Jessica Parker, Cynthia Nixon, and Kristen Davis as their characters Carrie Bradshaw, Miranda Hobbs, and Charlotte York. You may notice that a name is missing from that list. Kim Cattrall, who portrayed PR maven Samantha Jones in the series, will not be returning for the miniseries. Samantha isn't part of this story, but she will always be part of us, no matter what we do, Parker wrote on Instagram, in response to a commenter who alluded to Parker's rumored tension with co-star Cattrall. How Sex and the City will address Samantha's absence is one of the many questions we superfans have about the reboot. Unfortunately, we'll probably have to wait until the series returns for concrete answers. Speaking to Vanity Fair, Parker revealed she has just as many questions about the characters' lives as we do. Who are they in this world now? Have they adapted? What part have they played? Where have they fallen short as women, as friends, and how are they finding their way? Do they move with momentum? Are they like some people who are confused, threatened, nervous by what's happening in the world? I'm so curious and excited to see how the writers imagine these women today, Parker said. Michael Patrick King, the series' original showrunner, has assembled a writer's room to provide answers. Here's what we know about the revival. The limited series will consist of 10 half-hour episodes. Luckily, we have a lot more content to fall back on when the revival is finished. The original Sex and the City ran for 6 seasons with a total of 94 episodes. 2 Sex and the City's movies, one in 2008 and another in 2010, which continued the Friends stories. Speaking to Vanity Fair, Parker said that the COVID-19 pandemic will obviously be part of the storyline because that's the city these characters live in. And how has that changed relationships once friends disappear? Some fans speculate that COVID-19 may be the explanation for Samantha's absence. It's unclear if Chris Noth will return as Big in the series. Samantha may not be the only major character missing from the Sex and the City revival. In 2018, journalist James Andrew Miller claimed that the 3rd Sex and the City movie, which was never made, planned to feature Mr. Big's death. The script calls for Mr. Big to die of a heart attack in the shower, relatively early on in the film, making the remainder of the movie more about how Carrie recovers from Big's death than about the relationship between the 4 women, Miller said on his Origins podcast. Noth denied the rumors of his character's death. "There's no way he was dying. That was all a lie," Noth told the tabloid The Sun, adding that the series was over. Now some fans are wondering whether the unconfirmed plotline will be recycled for the TV revival. When a fan on Instagram asked about Noth's presence in the series, Parker responded, "Wait and see." Featuring a predominantly white cast, Sex and the City has long been critiqued for its lack of diversity. Speaking to The Hollywood Reporter 20 years after the finale, Parker called the series tone-deaf. She added, "You couldn't make it today because of the lack of diversity on screen. I personally think it would feel bizarre." According to Parker, the Sex and the City revival is trying to avoid making the mistakes of its predecessor. Parker said the show's new writer's room is incredibly diverse in a really exciting way. According to Parker's interview in Vanity Fair, the series is still being written. Luckily, the series should not have trouble filming on location in New York. Production on shows like Blue Bloods and New Amsterdam has resumed despite the pandemic, per the New York Times. After all, there wouldn't be a Sex and the City without the city. Okay, this next article is called Rebel Wilson Says People Treat Her Differently Following Her 60-Pound Weight Loss. After losing more than 60 pounds in 2020, Rebel Wilson reflected on her year of health on The Morning Crew with Husey, Ed, and Aaron. The 40-year-old actress opened up about sharing her weight loss journey publicly on Instagram and the reactions she's received after reaching her health goals. "I like to think I looked good at all sizes," Wilson said, "and I've always been quite confident, so it's not like I wasn't confident and now I'm super confident. The one thing that did change, what's been interesting is how people treat you. Sometimes, being bigger, people didn't necessarily look twice at you," she said. "Now that I'm in good shape, people offer to carry my groceries to the car or hold doors open for me." This led her to wondering whether people of smaller sizes have these interactions without even realizing it. "That to me has been really interesting," she said. Wilson has also been surprised by the amount of attention she's received on social media. "I find it interesting that people pay so much attention to a weight loss transformation when there's so much going on in the world," she admitted. Throughout 2020, Wilson documented her weight loss journey on Instagram, revealing all of the big and small changes she made to her diet, fitness, and self-care routine to reach her goals. This included hitting the gym most days of the week, lots of walking, and reaching for more nutritious foods, with a few treats sprinkled in. The actress previously shared that she struggled with emotional eating, and in an IGTV from December, she explained that it's still something she has to pay attention to if she's feeling particularly stressed or anxious. "It's not something that's just going to disappear. It's just something that I now have to manage moving forward," she said. Despite her weight loss, Wilson's not focused on the number on the scale. Instead, she tunes in to how she's feeling. I would say to everyone out there, do not be obsessed about how much you actually weigh. It's more about all the healthy practices and the changes to your lifestyle. All right, this next article is about Dolly Parton. It's called Dolly Parton is not sure she deserves the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Dolly Parton is not sure she would ever accept an honorable Presidential Medal of Freedom, even from President Joe Biden. But her decision to opt out of the award is not because she disapproves of the president. During an interview on Today with Hoda and Jenna per People, the iconic country singer shared that she had previously been offered the honor twice by the Trump administration, but declined to accept it both times due to poor timing. "While I actually have to be honest in all fairness, I got offered the Freedom Award from the Trump administration, and I couldn't accept it because my husband Carl Dean was ill," she said. While explaining why she turned down the second offer from the Trump administration, the singer also expressed her worry about accepting the medal from Biden, should he offer it to her, saying that then it would seem too political. "Then they asked me again about it, and I wouldn't travel because of the COVID, so now I'm feeling like if I take it, I'll be doing politics. So I'm not sure," said Parton. Former President Barack Obama has admitted in the past that he regrets not offering the national honor to the legendary musician, calling it a mistake on his part, during an interview on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Aside from the singer's years of philanthropic efforts, Parton has received recent praise for donating $1 million to the COVID-19 vaccine research at the start of the pandemic. "It's a nice compliment for people to think that I might deserve it," continued Parton. "But I don't work for those awards. It'd be nice, but I'm not even sure I deserve it." All right, this next article is called AOC says she's a survivor of sexual assault while recounting her story of the Capitol attack. When a pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was uncharacteristically tight-lipped about her experience. She tweeted to her followers to let them know she was okay before writing, "Was barricaded in for several hours. I'll tell y'all about it later." Less than a week later, the New York Congresswoman went on Instagram Live to explain that while she couldn't go into detail for security reasons, she had a very close encounter where I thought I was going to die. Then this Monday evening, after consulting security professionals, she went on Instagram Live to again share her story, but this time in full. AOC started by saying that part of the reason she's hesitated to tell her story is because she is a survivor of sexual assault and has struggled with the idea of not being believed. "The reason I'm getting emotional in this moment is because these folks who tell us to move on, that it's not a big deal, that we should forget what's happened, or even telling us to apologize, these are the same tactics of abusers," she said. "I am a survivor of sexual assault, and I haven't told many people in my life. When we go through trauma, trauma compounds on each other. And so whether you had a neglectful parent or whether you had someone who was verbally abusive to you, whether you are a survivor of abuse, whether you experienced any sort of trauma in your life, small to large, these episodes can compound one another." Representative Ocasio-Cortez then explained what she experienced in the days leading up to the attack, saying that the week prior she began getting text messages from people letting her know violence was to be expected on January 6th, and she needed to be careful. The Monday before the attack, she saw that Trump supporters were in town, holding rallies and coming near the Capitol, noting that she was surprised by the lack of security given the situation. By Tuesday, she noticed there were even more people around the Capitol and said it felt actively volatile and dangerous. On Wednesday, the day of the attack, Ocasio-Cortez said she was in her office when she heard banging on her door, as if someone was trying to break the door down. She specified that no one was yelling or identifying themselves, so her staffer instructed her to hide as she ran into a bathroom inside her office. "I just start to hear these yells of, 'Where is she? Where is she?'" she explained. "This was the moment where I thought everything was over. I thought I was going to die. she said with tears in her eyes. I felt that if this was the journey my life was taking, that I felt things were going to be okay, and that I had fulfilled my purpose. Eventually, she was able to look through the door hinges and see a white man in a black beanie inside our office. Her staffer told her it was okay to come out and that the man was a Capitol Police officer. It didn't feel right because he was looking at me with a tremendous amount of anger and hostility, she said. The officer told them to head to another building, so they ran over before realizing they weren't told exactly where in the building to go. Instead, they ended up inside Representative Katie Porter's office, where they sheltered together for hours. AOC said on the live that she felt completely unsafe during the attack, and once she found out all of the members of Congress were being directed to one location, decided that she shouldn't join. Later, the congresswoman ended up in Representative Ayanna Pressley's office and shared what had happened to her. When I told the story to Representative Pressley, she told me right away, "What you experienced was traumatizing, and you need to take care of yourself." I look back on that, and I think she really helped my healing. AOC ended the live by calling out Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley for propagating the lie that the presidential election was fraudulent, the same lie that incited the attack on the Capitol. "My story is not the only story, nor is it the central story," she said. "It's one of many stories of what these people did in creating this environment. These folks who are just trying to tell us to move on are, they're using the same tactics of every other abuser who just tells you to move on." Okay, and now we have an article called "The Secret to Pete Buttigieg and His Husband Chasten's Enduring Love." Pete Buttigieg has had a meteoric rise in the political career over the past few years, from serving as mayor of South Bend to running for president in 2020, not to mention his historic confirmation as Joe Biden's Secretary of Transportation on February 2, 2021. Lucky for Buttigieg, who was the first openly gay cabinet member to be Senate confirmed, he's had his biggest cheerleader by his side to encourage him, his husband, Chasten Buttigieg. While supporting Pete throughout his campaign, Chasten amassed a devoted following of his own, one that stands over 500,000 Twitter followers strong. Mashable called him the Twitter celebrity we deserve. Politico said at the time his husband was running for president that Chasten was winning the 2020 spouse primary. Before Pete ended his presidential campaign in March 2020, Chasten gave a speech that captured their devoted bond, one that intertwines the personal and the political. "About a year and a half ago, my husband came home from work and told me, well, he asked me, 'What do you think about me running for president?' And I laughed, not at him, but at life, because life gave me some interesting experiences on my way to find Pete. After falling in love with Pete, Pete got me to believe in myself again. And I told Pete to run because I knew there were other kids sitting out there in this country who needed to believe in themselves too," Chasten said. The couple, who were married in 2018, have an incredibly sweet and supportive relationship, which has won them and their dogs a devoted following. Below, a few key facts to know about Chasten, who, as the author of the memoir, I Have Something to Tell You, is a public figure in his own right. Chasten Glessman, his given name, grew up in a working-class family in Michigan and told the Washington Post that he often felt like a misfit alongside his brothers, who were into playing sports and hunting. "I would be inside reading Harry Potter or singing Celine Dion at the top of my lungs while my mom and I were dusting the cabinets," he said. His family's reaction to his coming out at the age of 18 was not positive. "I don't recall my parents specifically saying I couldn't live at home anymore, but I was made to believe I needed to leave," he said. Leaving home was the beginning of a tough period in which Chasten sometimes slept on friends' couches and sometimes slept in his car in the parking lot of his community college. Eventually, his mother called and asked, "Will you come home?" Chasten recalled to the Washington Post, "and I cried and I went home immediately." Though his relationship with his parents improved over time, they proudly walked him down the aisle when he married Pete. He remains estranged from his brothers. 11 years ago, when I came out, I didn't think there was a place for me in this world," he recalled in a tweet in May. As he shared he and Pete's story, 10 months ago, we said I do. 1 month ago, we said, let's do this. A truly relatable modern couple, Pete and Chasten met in the summer of 2015 on Hinge, the app which seems to be rapidly eclipsing Tinder in terms of popularity. At the time, the two were living in different states, but per the post, Chasten offered to visit Pete in South Bend. Their first meeting sounds like something right out of a romantic comedy. When Chasten got out of his car in front of Pete's house, they both said, howdy, at the same time. So gross, Chasten remarked to the post, but my heart fluttered. Their first date carried on in similar rom-com fashion. They bonded over scotch eggs, as you do. Then they watched a baseball game which featured fireworks. Literally, there were fireworks on our first date, Chasten told the Times. It was kind of ridiculous, I know, but I was hooked. Nothing says romance quite like Chicago's O'Hare Airport, but there's a story behind Pete's decision to propose at O'Hare. According to the couple's Time profile, it was in that airport that Chasten first saw Pete's dating profile on Hinge. The couple were married at the Episcopal Cathedral of St. James in South Bend in June of 2018, and if their New York Times wedding announcement is anything to go by, the wedding was incredible. Here's the announcement. It says, tacos from the Rico Suave food truck, sliders from South Bend's The Beard and the Boss, even the pork was local, provided by Gunthorpe Farms, a fourth-generation Indiana operation. Beer was from South Bend Brew Works, an assortment of regional cheeses from Oh Mama's Deli, salads from Café Navarre, lattes and coffee from Zen Café, housed inside Lang Lab, artisanal chocolates from local Violet Sky Chocolatier, specially created ice cream from the Outside Scoop, flavored with honey, harvested from community gardens, or whiskey from an Indiana distillery. Yes, hi, hello, is there a way for us to go back in time and crash this wedding, please? Just like the Bidens are proud owners of two German shepherds named Champ and Major, Chasten and Pete are dog parents, too. Their pups are named Truman and Buddy Buttigieg. The couple adopted Truman, a Beagle Labrador mix, in 2017. Buddy, a one-eyed Beagle Pug mix, joined their household last year. Truman and Buddy have a sizable social media following of their own. Their Twitter account currently has a following of more than 90,000, which is no surprise because every single update is a joy. If you generally find Twitter to be a bottomless pit of despair and rage that leaves you feeling much worse every time you log on, you might want to follow Chasten. His social feeds are relentlessly positive, even when he's touching on serious subject matter, and his Twitter generally features a mix of fun updates, premium dog content, and mindfulness tips. R. Eric Thomas really summed it up over at Elle when he wrote, quite literally, if the relentlessly upbeat potential first spouse ever took a social media break, I think I would spiral into a pit of despair that only a glint of light from Michelle Obama's Balenciaga boots could pull me out of. You owe it to yourself to make Chasten's updates a staple of your social media diet. Chasten used to be a junior high school teacher at Montessori Academy in Mishawaka, Indiana, having earned his master's in education at the nearby DePaul University. But after Pete announced he was running for president, Chasten left his job to support him full-time, alternating between joining Pete on the road and taking care of things at home. Though he was incredibly supportive, Chasten has admitted he wasn't sure how to react at first when Pete announced his plans. I laughed, he told the Post. I was like, no, no, no. Are you serious? Okay, what are we thinking here? I love you. I believe in you. You're amazing. Do you think this could work? 1 year ago, I married the love of my life, Pete wrote in an emotional June 16, 2019 Twitter update, as he marked his one-year wedding anniversary with Chasten. I'm so thankful I found you, Chasten, and can't wait to spend the rest of our life together. Meanwhile, Chasten posted some adorable couple pictures and revealed that he was en route to find this cute guy on the trail. Can't believe it's been 1 year. We know it's used all the time, but these two really are relationship goals. Chances are you're part of the Chasten fan club. Either you already were, or this article convinced you. In his recently published memoir, I Have Something to Tell You, you'll find the Chasten Buttigieg origin story in his own words. Earlier this year, OprahMag.com was lucky enough to publish an excerpt from the memoir about a particularly thrilling moment in Chasten and Pete's dating history. Pete, who was then a rising political star, invited Chasten to the White House's annual Christmas party, where he met none other than President Obama and the former First Lady. Clearly, the refreshingly candid, funny memoir offers a one-of-a-kind perspective on Washington, D.C., but the memoir also explores his life before Pete, not all of it easy. In the book, Chasten publicly discloses incidents of domestic violence in a past relationship and of sexual assault. I wanted to write my real story, and some of that was being really honest about what I thought, what I went through, and what I experienced and navigated, and some of it was heartbreaking, Chasten told USA Today. The couple attended the 2021 presidential inauguration together. Braving the January cold and wearing double masks, the couple bundled up in navy coats and scarves to watch President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris be sworn in at the Capitol. Approximately 2 weeks later, Buttigieg himself made headlines with his historic confirmation as Biden's transportation secretary. Okay, this next article is called Stacey Abrams Has Been Nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Stacey Abrams, the Democratic politician from Georgia, who has been credited as one of the leading figures who helped flip Georgia blue for President Joe Biden in the November 2020 election, has officially been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for her work on voting rights. Reuters reported that the Norwegian Parliament member Lars Haltbrekken announced her nomination earlier. Abrams' work follows in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s footsteps in the fight for equality, before the law and for civil rights, said Haltbrekken, per the outlet. Abrams' efforts to complete King's work are crucial if the United States of America shall succeed in its effort to create fraternity between all its peoples and a peaceful and just society. Abrams gained national attention when she ran for governor of Georgia in 2018, ultimately losing to Republican Brian Kemp by a margin of less than 2 percentage points. Exposing voter suppression in her state was a cornerstone of her campaign. After losing the gubernatorial race, Abrams launched Fair Fight Action, a voter education campaign that took the fight against voter suppression across the country. We have watched the undermining of our democracy not just for the last 4 years under Trump, but for the last 20 years under Republicans, because they are a very homogenous party that relies on keeping people out of the process. Their only way to continue their dominance is to keep voter suppression in place. But they've also eroded our democracy, because the thing is, you may target people of color, you may target young people, but when you break the machinery of democracy, you break it for everyone. All right, now we have an article called Oprah Responds to Cicely Tyson's Death. Her life so fully lived is a testimony to greatness. Pioneering star of stage, film, and television, Cicely Tyson died on January 28th at 96 years old. I have managed Miss Tyson's career for over 40 years, and each year was a privilege and a blessing, the Emmy and Tony-winning actress's manager, Larry Thompson, said in a statement. Cicely thought of her new memoir as a Christmas tree, decorated with all the ornaments of her personal and professional life. Today she placed the last ornament, a star, on top of the tree. Tyson, whose breakout role was in Odds Against Tomorrow, alongside Sidney Poitier in 1959, later went on to receive her first Oscar nomination for Sounder in 1972. Over the span of her 9-decade career, she had other memorable parts in Roots and Fried Green Tomatoes, just to name a couple. Tyson was awarded an honorary Oscar in 2018 at the age of 93. However, it was perhaps her television work that she was most famous for, particularly 1974's The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. Tyson purposefully abstained from the popular blaxploitation era movies of the 70s that often perpetuated negative black stereotypes, turning down roles that she deemed belittling to black people. In one of her last interviews, she told Gail King on CBS This Morning that she decided early on, "I could not afford the luxury of just being an actress, and I would use my career as a platform." Upon hearing about the passing of her friend, Oprah posted a moving tribute on Instagram to Cicely Tyson. "Of all the times and experiences we shared together, this was one of my favorites. The weekend of the Legends Ball in 2005. The idea for the ball originated because I wanted to celebrate her and other remarkable black women who carved a path and built a bridge for me and generations to follow. What a joy to honor her and feel her receive it. I loved her hat so much," she sent it to me afterwards. Cicely decided early on that her work as an actor would be more than a job. She used her career to illuminate the humanity of black people. The roles she played reflected her values. She never compromised. Her life, so fully lived, is a testimony to greatness. The barrier-breaking actress, who was once married to jazz musician Miles Davis, published a memoir, Just As I Am, 2 days before her death. In it, the Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient wrote in the introduction that she wanted to share how my tree, my story, first sprung into existence, how its roots, stretching far beyond the soil, have nourished and anchored me. At the end of their interview, when Gail asked Tyson what people truly need in life, Gail said, answering as a black woman, Tyson shared the basic fundamentals are cayenne pepper, a stash of cash, and a quiet place. Okay, this next article is about Ricky Lake. It's called Ricky Lake Opens Up About Debilitating Hair Loss a Year After Shaving Her Head. After 30 years of silent suffering, Ricky Lake has fully embodied self-love and is embracing her head of sparse silver hair. But she hasn't always felt this way. Debilitating hair loss, as she described it to Good Morning America, put her in defense mode for most of her life, trying everything from vitamins to wigs to hair extensions. Finally, she grew tired of the fight and made the bold decision to shave her head. "It was such a rite of passage last year, taking the leap of faith to shave my head, and my hair, thankfully, has grown back," the actress, 52, explained on a January 27 segment. "And I learned so much going through the process of really letting go of something that had been really bothering me." Once she had finally done the deed, a new anxiety overcame her. "I was afraid of coming out," she recently told People, "because no woman, as far as I knew, had ever gone public about female baldness." Last year, she ended up telling the world in an emotional Instagram post that now has over 73,000 likes. "I have been struggling with hair loss for most of my adult life," she wrote at the time. "It has been debilitating, embarrassing, painful, scary, depressing, lonely, all the things. There have been a few times where I have even felt suicidal over it. Almost no one in my life knew the level of deep pain and trauma I was experiencing. Not even my therapist over the years knew my truth." She attributed her hair loss to constant dyeing, styling, and teasing over her years in show business, particularly during her 1988 role as Tracy Turnblad in Hairspray. Yo-yo dieting, hormonal changes, stress, pregnancy, and genetics, among other things, and she tried every possible solution to make it stop. "I've been to many doctors, gotten steroid shots in my head, taking all the supplements and then some. My hair would recover and then shed again. It was maddening," she wrote. A year after the big shave, she's rocking a salt and pepper pixie style with the help of a Scandinavian hair company. "This topical extract has been a game changer for me," Lake wrote on Instagram, showing off her progress. According to People, She has been diagnosed with a hereditary condition called androgenetic alopecia. My hope is that I'm able to help others struggling, as I did for far too long, Lake continued. This journey has been such a gift to me. I finally, truly love my hair, and more importantly, love myself unconditionally, from the inside out. All right, next we have an article called Mindy Kaling Would Totally Get Involved in an Office Reboot. When Mindy Kaling was pregnant with her first child, Catherine, a.k.a. Kit, in 2017, it was our very own Oprah who inadvertently broke the news. After Kaling casually mentioned to Oprah and Reese Witherspoon that she was expecting, while standing in the press line at Disney's D23 Expo for A Wrinkle in Time, which they had worked on together, Lady O happened to be the person to enthusiastically report the tidbit during an interview with People. I have to say, that was one of the most glamorous baby announcements, Mindy Kaling jokes to OprahMag.com. I mean, who else gets to say that Oprah Winfrey confirmed your existence? My daughter will always know that. Oprah made up for it in true O fashion by sending Catherine a huge, gorgeous bookshelf of books, according to Kaling. However, when Kaling welcomed her second child, her son Spencer, in September, she managed to keep the birth to herself. When I chatted with the mother of two on Zoom, I ever so coolly began the conversation by saying that I go to bed with her every night. It's true, if off-putting. Fortunately, she took it in stride, responding, "I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I love it." I explained that rewatching The Mindy Project, which she co-wrote and starred in, has become a self-soothing pastime, and lately I've been falling asleep with the audio version of her latest book, Nothing Like I Imagined, in my AirPods. It's something Kaling, who has been open about grappling with loneliness, could fully relate to. In fact, pop culture has been one of her key coping mechanisms during quarantine, too. The pandemic has been so terrible for so many reasons, and one of the most overlooked reasons is mental health, and people who really thrive and survive on their interactions with their friends and families are being robbed of them, particularly elderly people, she explains. Kaling, who lost her mom to cancer in 2012, says, "My dad is 75, and he luckily has my stepmom, and they're together, but it's really hard for him not to see his grandchildren. And for me, you know. I'm not married. I'm a single mom, and I've always been someone who loves pop culture, loves TV, loves film. But this year, it has really helped me survive." She adds, "Watching Queen's Gambit, catching up on old episodes of 30 Rock, I think those are the kind of things that make you feel connected with the world, when you can laugh and get pulled in with someone. Even Twitter. Everyone has their opinion about Twitter, but that makes me feel more connected too, even though I'm a single woman. I love my social media. I love my TV, even though I was raised to think TV was terrible. And then, you know, I became a TV writer. So with Never Have I Ever and other shows I'm working on, if I can provide content for someone who feels lonely or upset, and that's their outlet for it, that is, to me, a great win." The second season of her thoughtful coming-of-age Netflix series, Never Have I Ever, which is on hiatus from filming due to COVID-19, is just one of the projects Kaling has brewing. Along with her friend, Brooklyn Nine-Nine creator Dan Gore, she wrote a comedy that she'll also star in with Priyanka Chopra Jonas. It's a great role for her. People might not know how funny Priyanka is. And as for the hotly anticipated Legally Blonde 3, she and Gore just finished their first draft, and soon will let Reese read it, so hopefully she'll like it, she says. Kaling, who cut her teeth as a writer on The Office starting in 2005, is also not opposed to being involved in a reboot of that, which showrunner Greg Daniels told Collider is not impossible, provided he's involved. But the ongoing Pam and Jim level of will-they-won't-theys regarding a revival comes as a bit of a surprise to Kaling, who also starred as the beloved Kelly Kapoor. "That's always news to me. I always feel like I hear about Office reboot news when I'm doing interviews. I loved working on that show. It was the way I got into the business, and I feel so loyal to Steve Carell and to Greg Daniels. And if I knew Steve and Greg were going to be involved, I would 100% come back and help in any way I could. The breezy Zoom concluded with some extra candor from the 41-year-old multi-hyphenate who partnered with Campbell's for their Well Yes Soups campaign about an ever-present topic we've all been bombarded with since resolution messaging is top of mind. The Quarantine 15. Kaling, who is known for promoting positivity and empowerment of all kinds, went viral over the summer of 2019 when she posted a bikini pic with the caption, "I don't know who needs to hear this, but wear a bikini if you want to wear a bikini. You don't have to be a size zero." But despite her pervasive optimism, mixed, of course, with her signature dry wit, she was open about the fact that she was anxious to shoot her Vogue India December cover when she was less than 2 months postpartum. "I had my baby during quarantine, so my quarantine 15 was like a quarantine 30. Whenever I hear someone just put on 15 pounds during the quarantine, I'm amazed and jealous of them. And I love that cover, and I felt I looked really beautiful. But I was nervous about it because we shot it 6 weeks after I gave birth. And unlike my first pregnancy where I was in the public eye, I was shooting my show, I was promoting A Wrinkle in Time. This one, I didn't have any of those things, so I could comfortably put on weight." One of the silver linings, she says, is because I wasn't on camera, I could kind of lose the weight and get into my regular eating patterns at my own pace. One of the really nice things about partnering with Well Yes is that it's this incredibly nutritious and nourishing thing that I can eat that's really easy, and that helps me count my calories in a healthy way. And I've been able to phase in a healthier lifestyle myself with the help of the soup. So it's been much better this time, she confides while sipping on a butternut squash bisque. "I haven't had that immediate pressure of, hey, you have to be in a movie and be back on your TV show in 6 weeks. So this has been a lot more casual, and I feel like everyone is doing it. Everyone's looking to shed their pandemic 15, 30, whatever. So I feel like I'm in a broader group. As a member of that broader group, mostly because I'll subscribe to anything Kaling espouses, I'll remember these words as she's cooing in my ears tonight." Okay. Here is a story called Even Oprah and Barack Obama Watch The Crown. The Crown returned for season 4 back in November, and since then our internet search histories have been full of tabs about sapphire engagement rings, Princess Diana's childhood, and how Michael Fagan managed to climb up Buckingham Palace's walls and into the Queen's bedroom. Really, though, how? To its devoted following, Netflix's sumptuous Windsor-centric drama is more than a TV show. It's practically a sporting event. And according to the latest episode of The Oprah Conversation, streaming now on Apple TV+, Oprah and former President Barack Obama are also two of The Crown's viewers. In fact, The Crown was mentioned twice during their virtual interview, which was otherwise devoted to discussing Obama's new memoir, A Promised Land, about the early years of the presidency. Before the pair dove into the episode's granular topics, which included Obama's reaction to Joe Biden's victory, Obama asked Oprah how she's passed time in quarantine. Oprah, who has spent the pandemic in Santa Barbara with her partner Stedman Graham and her daughters, that's in air quotes because they're not her biological daughters, Sade and Thondo, immediately named the Netflix show. "We watched every episode of The Crown," Oprah said. Oprah's other go-to quarantine activities include popsicle making, Friday night dance parties, and reading, of course. "It's been fun having the girls at home," she added, and Obama agreed. The topic of The Crown came up again during the interview's midway break as the fireplace in Oprah's living room was stoked. Obama, who visited with Queen Elizabeth II 3 times during his 2-term presidency, has a special perspective on the show. "Knowing the Queen pretty well, it's fascinating to see that trajectory of her life," Obama said of the Netflix series, which follows Elizabeth's reign through the 90s. "I don't know the Queen at all, and it's fascinating," Oprah added. Though this does spark an idea. Perhaps the Queen could join Oprah on the next socially distanced episode of The Oprah Conversation? According to palace insiders, the queen herself is also possibly among the crown's fans. According to a senior royal source, Queen Elizabeth II was introduced to the Netflix show by her son, Prince Edward, who once had his own television production company, and his wife Sophie, Countess of Wessex. Edward and Sophie love the crown, the source told the Sunday Express in 2017. It has been a long-standing arrangement that they drive to Windsor at the weekend to join the queen for an informal supper while watching TV or a film. They have a Netflix account and urged her to watch it with them. Happily, she really liked it, although obviously there were some depictions of events that she found too heavily dramatized. All right, and now I'm going to read about some essential oils that can help you beat stress. Aromatherapy essential oils are considered good for stress, providing a calming effect when they're incorporated into your regular routine, though they're not a cure-all. Marisa Snyder, wellness practitioner and author of The Essential Oils Hormone Solution, says that while oils can lower your cortisol levels and support your body, finding other ways to relax is key. Focus on proper nutrition and exercise and implementing self-care strategies, she says. In other words, they shouldn't be the only go-to items in your self-soothing toolkit. You may also want to try mindfulness meditation, any one of the great yoga apps out there, or even seeing a therapist. Still, it's definitely worth trying essential oils for stress and anxiety relief, given that fans will tell you that oils can really help with everything from seasonal allergies to getting better sleep. Plus, they're affordable, and by and large, they happen to smell terrific. Try lavender oil or bergamot oil, mandarin oil, sandalwood oil, Roman chamomile oil, or neroli oil. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.